Everybody in life, whether we're a small child or a grown adult or an old person, whatever stage of life that we're at, whether we're a monk or a nun, whether we're a lay person, we have hair or a shaved head, all of us are looking for happiness. All of us want to enjoy happiness. But happiness is something that is quite elusive. Sometimes it's hard to find, and no matter how hard we try to get hold of the things or to have the things that will bring happiness, oftentimes happiness escapes us. You know, we think that if we go to the right place, or if we have the right things, or if we have the right environment, we go to the right school, or we go to the right monastery, or we have the right house, watch the right TV programs, or have the right meditation practice even, yeah, we will find happiness. But sometimes, even no matter how hard we try, it escapes us. It runs away. We find it hard to keep a hold of. So one of the things that is most helpful, I found from the teachings that I received from my teacher, my main teacher, Ajahn Chah, was a very, very simple teaching that if you want to be happy, you have to create the causes of happiness. Happiness doesn't just sort of come along and land on us, you know, that kind of contentment in our heart. He would say, all of us like to be happy, but we don't do the things that will bring happiness. And all of us don't want to experience unhappiness, yet we love to do the things that bring unhappiness. We don't realize we're doing this, but this is the way that it works. So one of the ways that we develop happiness, or we bring happiness into our life, the basic, the most central thing, is learning how not to be selfish. As long as I am the most important person in the world, and everything is has to be the way I like and what I want, we don't realize it, but if we think that way, then that's what's going to make us unhappy almost all of the time. And that the more that we're unselfish, the more that we're ready to let go of our idea that I am the most important person, then we find that we create a lot of the causes, the supports for happiness in our life. I remember when I was very new in the monastery, I didn't even think that I was an Anagarika. You see, the Anagarikas are the ones who wear white. They're on eight precepts, so they're the kind of uncooked monks, like tofu. You know, when it's straight out of the slab, it's kind of white and pale, and when you roast it for a while, then it gets brown. So that we're the well roasted ones on this side, and then they're the raw tofu on the right there. And so I don't think I was even out of the tofu packet. I was still just very raw material in the monastery. I was just a few weeks I'd been there, and I remember there was a novice who lived there. He was from France. He was called Ginoaro. And I remember this incident very, very clearly, because it was quite a turning point in my life. And some of you might know that in the monastery we have lots and lots of rules. And one of the rules is that like in the eight precepts that we were chanting this evening, that, you know, say people who are visiting, you know, maybe you just take on the eight precepts just for the evening. And then, but in the monastery, that's the way that we live all the time. So that rule about not eating at inappropriate times, that means we don't have any food to eat between noon, from 12 o'clock, until dawn of the next day. That's a long time. So we fast every day for about 17 hours. So that's a long time to go without eating. So what happens, and also in those times when I was living in Thailand, northeast Thailand, the diet was very, very poor. So there's almost no vitamins or proteins or minerals or anything. So when you are sort of young and vigorous, I was 21 at the time, yeah, you can get pretty hungry. And so And you can think about food a lot, and you can think about particularly about sweet things. Yeah. Sugar becomes extraordinarily important. And you might think, well, before I went to the monastery, I thought, I don't really care about sugar, sweets, you know, hadn't eaten candies for a long time. Not interested in that. I'm a grown up. You know, who cares about candies? But after a few weeks of living in the monastery in Thailand, you know, I became seriously interested in sugar. Extremely seriously interested. It was like major, major currency. This is like really valuable stuff. And what happened was this French novice, Gino Waro, he got a care package from his parents in France. And even though we're not allowed to have any food in the afternoon, there's certain things are classed as medicines. Now you might think medicines are things like aspirin, you know, or cough mixture or all those things. But also, along with medicines, and those kind of regular over-the-counter type medicines, then things like honey or sugar even are counted as medicines because they have a kind of tonic quality. They can invigorate. And so for some reason, according to the Buddhist rules, sugar managed to be classed as a medicine. So therefore sugar was something that was allowable in the afternoon, which meant we could have candies in the afternoon. But of course candies were extremely rare. Like, you never saw them, ever. But then Gino Waro got this care package from his family in France, and they sent a packet of candies. In this, along with the other things that were useful, like, you know, good sharp razor blades and other useful things. And so there, you know, because there was just a few of us in the monastery at the time, and he was sort of down at the junior end of the line where I was as a visitor. I was around when he opened up this packet and saw that he had this whole bag full of candies, and I thought, wow. Now, my attitude sort of up until this point in my life was, if I've got something like that, you know, a bag full of sweets, the main principle is lots for me. This is my stuff. This is great because I've got lots and lots of nice things that I want for me, and that's good. That was my thought. And so, to my amazement, because Gino Waro was making the tea that day and preparing that for everyone, he went around, he took this bag full of candies, and he offered candies to all of the other monks and novices. And I couldn't believe it. I saw him going around, he was giving a couple to everybody, and till there was only like two or three left. And I thought, that's amazing. And, you know, he's given them, you know, all away. And he'd had, I think, one or maybe two on his own. But if it was me, I would have, like, eaten about 25 and then maybe thought about, you know, my guilty conscience and given away a couple. But he gave most of them away and just had a couple for himself. And so I remember him offering me the bag, and there was only, like, two or three left. And I said, don't you want to keep those for yourself? And he said, they are much more delicious if I share them. And I remember it very clearly because that thought had never occurred to me during my entire life, even without the French accent. I'd never ever had that thought, that something would be more delightful, more delicious if you share it with other people. What an amazing thing. And I saw that he wasn't just trying to, you know, sort of put that on, but he really felt that. He really understood that. So that was a very powerful lesson to me, that when we are unselfish, when we share our things, when we offer that up to others, then we find there's a great deal more happiness. We feel joy. One of the things that we discover in life is that if we are unselfish, this is what leads to a real contentment, a real joyfulness. When we share what we have, that makes our heart really at ease and happy. So I take Gino Waro as one of my early teachers, even though he didn't stay as a monk for very long. But I remember him very fondly because that was a very important lesson. So that when I feel that impulse to get more for me, then I remember that voice saying, they are more delicious. And then I tried it afterwards, and it's true. You know, if you have a bunch of stuff and you have it all for yourself, even though you get lots and you might feel, you know, there's some kind of pleasure in it, there's a sort of bitterness there. There's a kind of unhappiness because, you know, there's a sort of, I want all of this, I'm going to keep it. And that selfishness makes an unpleasant taste within us. So that was one important lesson of how to find happiness. And another story I like to tell about the same monk was where I learnt the value of compassion. Compassion means a feeling of appreciating someone else's sorrow or their unhappiness, that you're opening your heart to their own difficulty if things are painful or hard for them. So in those days, Jinawara was the one who made the drink. See, nowadays in this monastery, we have a kind of supply of tea and coffee and things, and people mix up their own drinks. But in those days, it was the job of one of the novices or one of the anagarikas. It would be their job each day to brew up a big kettle of drink. And, you know, in those days, we didn't have electricity. So, you know, actually, even boiling water was a complicated process. You had to get the cooking pot, the earthenware stove, and you get the dried sticks of jute and then the charcoal, and you have to light them and get them going and get the water boiling. And it took a long time. It took about 3/4 of an hour, even an hour, to boil a big pot of water. And so on this particular day, Jinawaro had made the tea, and it was to my surprise that he came over. It was just about 10 minutes or 15 minutes before the tea time was coming, where we were going to offer it to all of the monks. And he came over and found me in this other part of the back part of the monastery where I was sitting. And he had this look on his face. It was like this sort of, like a broken mirror. It's like, he's kind of extremely upset and miserable, and, you know, lines all over his face. And he was, and I said, "What's the matter? You look really terrible. What's the problem?" He said, "It is disgusting." I said, "What is?" He said, "The drink I make with herb tea, but it is disgusting. I try everything. I put in the sugar, and with sugar it tastes horrible. So then I try to cover the sugar with some salt, and then because I think maybe it should not have sugar, so I put in some salt because it is supposed to be savory. But that does not work. So then I think maybe some chili powder to kind of spice it up, to cover the sugar and the salt. But it is disgusting." So this was a few months later, and I was pretty proud of my ability as a drink maker. I thought I could make the most wonderful exotic. Because again, you know, we were all living a very simple life, and the diet was very poor. And so the afternoon drink, which was usually a sweet drink, that was a big feature of the day. You know, no TV, no MP3 players, no music, no fun at all, no distractions, and so not even talking together very much. So gathering together and having a sweet drink was like the sort of the big hit for the senses each day. And so poor Jinawaro, he'd made this drink, and it was really terrible. And so and I thought I was a pretty good drink maker. I could make these really killer, if that's not an un-Buddhist term, kind of these killer sweet drinks. And I was really proud of my abilities. So I thought, don't worry about it, I'll take care of it, no problem. So I went over and I said, and so he poured some out into a cup for me, and I started drinking it. Wow, this is revolting. He's right, it's disgusting. So I thought, okay, well, let's think about this. And so I tried to go to work on it, and so I thought, well, what did you make this thing with in the first place? And it so happened that there was a man who'd been a monk in our monastery for 6 or 7 years, and he was famous as a kind of sugar and coffee addict. It's cool. When he was a monk, he was called Warapanyo. And even today, 30 years later, Warapanyo stories still circulate about the extreme things that Warapanyo got up to in terms of his search for sugar and caffeine and happiness through a kind of intake. So even though Warapanyo was famous as a sugar freak and a coffee fan when he was a monk, what had happened was that when he disrobed, he left the monk's life, gone back to America, and had seen the light that caffeine was all bad, sugar was terrible for you, and he'd gone onto a kind of purification trip. And so this package had arrived from him a couple of weeks before, and everyone thought, oh wow, care package from Warapanyo, this will be some really great stuff. But actually, when you open the care package, it was peppermint tea, chamomile tea, and various other kinds of herb teas. But in amongst the herb teas, there are also some medicinal herbs as well. Things like golden seal and wormwood. And I asked Gino, what did you use to make the tea? And he says, well, I looked in the box from Warapanyo, and I did not know what they all were, so I chose this one, which is called wormwood. And for those of you who don't know, wormwood is extremely bitter. It's really kind of, it's very good medicine, but it's very foul tasting. And I thought, oh dear. And so I duly went to work, and I tried to fix this drink, but eventually I tried a bit more of this and a bit more of that, because you couldn't just reboil the water, because you couldn't just sort of plug in the kettle. You know, you'd have to sort of throw the whole lot out, get another jug of cold water and boil it from scratch. Not enough time. So I thought, well, okay, you know, you just go back to your hut, go back to your kuti, don't worry about it, and I'll serve up the drink. And I'll deal with it. Don't you worry, because he was so upset, and he thought he was going to have a terrible time. All of the monks were going to blame him for making this horrible drink. So I decided that I would we should offer the drink, and I would take the blame. And so this is where the compassion comes in. So I served it up, and at that time it was a cold season, so we were sitting outside. It was a nice kind of cool time of the year, and we had the grass mats out under the trees, and so I served passed the drink out and served it to all of the different monks. And then, you know, in the monastery we do everything in order. So the senior monk got the drink first, and then the next. And I just got to the last of the sort of junior monks and the novices. And suddenly I heard this kind of, well, I won't demonstrate. What is this? It was the abbot was this kind of 6'4" American former helicopter pilot, about this wide at the shoulders, this big guy, and he sort of burst forth with this huge spurt of wormwood, chili, sugar, salty, revolting soup. What is this? And then you could hear this kind of spurting from all the other monks as they each took sips down, and he went down like sort of cascade of choking and coughing and spluttering. And so, it's wormwood, Ajahn. And so there was all of the rest of the monks and novices then started to offer their comments and accusations and criticisms of me as the most appalling drink maker that ever existed. But even though I was getting all this blame and people were very unhappy and miserable, it was also, I felt this kind of warmth in my heart, because I thought, well, at least Gina Wara is not getting blamed for this, because he was so upset and so kind of, he was practically in tears. He was almost crying. He was so sad for having made such a mess up of it. So even though I didn't like getting criticized or blamed for anything, I was quite happy in myself, because at least I'm helping my friend out, and he can just sort of hide away and and not be the receiving end of all of this negativity. Now, this is also a time when I started to begin to believe in what in English is called divine intervention, or having when the gods come and help you out. Because just as all of the monks and novices were kind of grumbling and complaining and criticizing me for this horrible drink, it's kind of the worst drink that ever existed, a pickup truck arrived in the monastery. Now, in those days, you might think, well, so what? You know, that's nothing unusual. But in those days, there were not very many cars. This was very, very far out in the backwoods of Thailand. You know, not many cars, not many people had pickup trucks. And people very rarely came to visit at that time of day in the monastery. It's kind of late afternoon. And visitors almost always came in the mealtime, in the morning, like about 8 or 8:30. So this pickup truck arrived. And then these people got out. And then in the back of the pickup truck, there was two crates of Fanta and Pepsi. Mm-hmm. Not only did they have these crates of Fanta and Pepsi, they had buckets of ice as well. And these were people we'd never met before. So they came out, walked up to the Ajahn with their crates of Pepsi and Fanta, offered these to the Ajahn, brought out their buckets of ice, offered the buckets of ice, bowed and paid their respects, and went back to their car. And if I remember correctly, they just drove off. Who are these people? So, before everyone had time to dwell on their kind of the misery of having such a horrible drink, then there were these. And then you might think, well, so what, bottle of Fanta? You put a bottle of Pepsi, but again, you just must remember this is serious currency. I mean, you might see a bottle of Pepsi or a soda like once a week or once every couple of weeks if you are lucky. And ice was really rare. So at that moment, I thought, thank you, whoever arranged this, thank you very much. So I was very appreciative of that. That was a kind of amazing thing. So I don't know how these things work, but certainly I could see the main point of telling the story is that when we are compassionate in that kind of way, and we look out for the unhappiness or the difficulty of others, and we reach out to them and help, then even though it's difficult for us, then we feel it brings a happiness and a contentment to our own heart as well. So not only is that person helped, but we too are helped in our own way. And that's a very beautiful thing. So we create the causes of happiness for ourselves. We benefit ourselves. And also you get a good story to tell for the next 25 years. Another of the ways we can be... we can develop happiness. Maybe one last thing to share with you all is a quality of forgiveness. Forgiveness is something that's... Because it's very easy, you know, when you've had a fight with someone, or, you know, you've had some kind of clash, or something, you know, someone's done you wrong, or you think something's unfair, or someone hasn't sort of done what they should have done. Like maybe if you're a parent and your child hasn't behaved the way they should, then you want to scold them, and so that it's very easy for us to be unforgiving, to kind of carry around this bad feeling of like, he did this and she did that, and he shouldn't have done this and she shouldn't have done that, and that's not right, and how dare they. And whether it's from a younger person to an older person, or an older person to a younger person, it's very easy for the mind to find good reasons to complain about each other, right? You can say, we can build up stories. We can, what they call, collect the evidence. All the things that so-and-so has done wrong, and how they shouldn't be that way, and they've hurt my feelings. It's not good. So when I first recognized or saw the power of forgiveness, or kind of not... someone not holding a grudge, or not acting in that way, it was when I was an anagarika by this time. And again, I've told this story many times, but again, like these events with my friend Gina Waro, this was had a very powerful effect on me, because just like when I saw Gina Waro saying, you know, they're more delicious if I share them, and I never thought had that thought in my mind. This was another occasion where I experienced something for the first time in my life. Now, I'm a night person. You know, I like to stay up late at night. If I have a choice, I'll always sleep in the morning and then stay up to like midnight or 2 or 3 in the morning. That's, you know, my preference. So, you know, I've been in the monastery a long time, and I'm still waiting for the day when my alarm goes at 3:45 and I think, yes! Hello, day! When my alarm goes at 3:45 in the morning, I usually think, no, 5 more minutes, or 10. See, nowadays they have invented these snooze, you know, the snooze button. Back in those days, they didn't have snooze buttons on alarms. But anyway, I've always struggled to get up early in the morning. And my tendency will be to oversleep. Anyhow, on this one particular day, I was an anagarika, so I'd been in the monastery a few months, but I was very keen and always made my best effort to get up and be on time. And at this time also, the abbot, Ajahn Prabhakara, had forgiven me for the terrible wormwood tea, and I was his attendant, so I kind of looked after his things. And so in the morning time, when it was the time to go out round the village just at dawn, then I was the one who had to get his robes together and get everything organized, have his bowl all sort of prepared, so he could just put his robes on, pick up his bowl and walk out the door. And so there's a special way that the attendant would get all of those things ready, and so that was my job. And, you know, I was pretty together doing that. We'd have the morning meditation, the chanting and the sitting, and then after that, then some of the monks would go out right at dawn, and then another group would go about half an hour later to the nearest village. And so the Ajahn Prabhakara, he would go on the later one, to the near village. So it was after it was already daylight. Now, on this particular occasion, Ajahn Chah, our teacher, was also staying in the monastery, which was very rare and very special. So it was everyone was very excited about having him there, and it was a wonderful thing, and it was very inspiring to have him and to hear his teachings. And so he'd stayed overnight, and so in the morning it was had to get his things together and also the things for Ajahn Prabhakara. So anyway, on this particular morning, I woke up, and I lived in this little hut, and it was a very kind of roughly built little hut. And there were cracks between the wooden planks that made up the walls. And I woke up and I thought, wow, the moonlight's really bright. The moonlight's really bright. Now hang on. The full moon was 2 weeks ago. Huh? The moonlight is very bright. I looked at my clock. 1:33, and no tick. The clock's not ticking. It says 1:33. There's bright light outside. Ah! So immediately fearing that, oh my God, you know, I'm supposed to be getting the Ajahn's things together to go out and arms round, and I've overslept. I don't know what time it is. I don't have a watch. My clock has stopped. So I threw on my clothes and raced through the forest, most undignified, because of course, you know, even anagarikas, let alone monks and novices, are never supposed to run. Note, monastic community here. Shaven-headed monastics never run. But I hurtled at high speed through the forest, got to the back of the hall, and I saw the clock. Ah, 6:25. Great. I'm in the clear. Great. Okay, so play nonchalant. You know, pretend that you've been here all the time. You know, you sit at the back. It was kind of dim light. They probably didn't even see you went around. Ajahn Prabhakara and Ajahn Chah kind of sitting there chatting away in Lao and kind of cracking jokes and having a good time. And, okay, move in the back, get the robes, arrange the robes, and, you know, pretend like nothing has happened. They won't have noticed. Right? This is my thinking, you know. If in doubt, deceive. This is not a very dharmic policy, but it was my kind of lifelong habit. If in doubt, pretend. try and trick people into thinking everything's fine. So anyway, I sort of got the Ajahn Prabhakara's robes together, Ajahn Chah's robes together, got the bowls all sorted, and got everything in place. And so finally, then Ajahn Chah's putting his robes on, and I'm just, what we do is like tying up the little loops and tags that join the ends of the ropes together. And I'm just doing that for Ajahn Chah's robe. So I'm sort of kneeling down at his feet and fixing his robe. And then he said something to Ajahn Prabhakara, and they both chuckled, both kind of laughed. And I was kind of, what did he say? What was that? And so, and then I looked up, and Ajahn Chah had this kind of foot wide, he had this huge mouth, but this, and he had this grin that was about this wide, and he was looking at me. And I looked up sort of quite a bit worried to Ajahn Prabhakara and said, what did he say? And he said, he replied, he said, sleep is delicious. And so then, so of course, the initial feeling is, oh God, I've been found out. The headmaster knows. The boss is going to punish me. And then I looked at Ajahn Chah's face, and there was just this big grin. This kind of incredibly friendly, kindly grin. There was no trace of any kind of anger or scolding or punishing me for anything. It was there was no harshness there at all. There was a complete forgiveness. And at that moment, everything in me was prepared for the authority, the boss, to be angry, to punish me, that you shouldn't have done that, you're an unangry, what are you doing? Because of course he could see, I was only been awake for about 4 minutes, so my kind of eyes were all puffy, and I'm kind of face is still crumpled from the pillow, and all those kind of telltale signs of, and he knows what a just woken up anagarika looks like. He's been in the monastery for a long time, so he was experienced, he would know. So I wasn't going to fool him. But even though he wasn't fooled, he knew I'd only just woken up. He didn't care. And also that's that way to say sleep is delicious. That, yeah, right, okay, you have just been awake, and I'm aware of that, and you're aware of that, and sleep is delicious. That I also recognize how nice it is to sleep, and how we can enjoy that. And so there was like no blame, complete kind of forgiveness and friendliness. And this was the first time in my life I experienced like an authority having a completely good reason to punish or scold or to be harsh, and to have that quality of complete, utter, 100% forgiveness and friendliness. And then that was at the moment I realized, this is a different system. These people are different. This is a different way of operating. And so that was such a powerful example of forgiveness. So that when I would see my own mind doing that, because of course, even though I grew up thinking, I'm never going to be like my dad and kind of scold people or get angry and upset with those who are junior. Of course, those impulses do arise. How can you do that? I remember that image of Ajahn Chah and his face and him saying, sleep is delicious. So I can remember that the power of that quality of forgiveness and kindness, and how how much a gift that is, so that we are not carrying around any kind of criticism of others, but we remember that when we are ready to forgive, to be kindly, to not blame or criticize, then that's both a beautiful experience for the person that we could be blaming, like the person who you are forgiving. They're happy not to be barked at, not to be kind of getting any kind of negativity, and it's also pleasant for us. Yes, it's kind of a nice experience for us, that we too are benefited by not carrying around that kind of horrible feeling of kind of criticizing or blaming others. That Because it's also, you know, when, even though you might be right, you know, he shouldn't be like that, and she shouldn't have done this, and she's all wrong. Even if you're right, what does it feel like in our heart when we're blaming or criticizing or being unforgiving like that? It's a horrible feeling, isn't it? And so that when we choose, we make that choice to be kind, to be forgiving, to let go, then it's a benefit to others and also a great benefit to ourselves. So these are just some stories to share, to give a little example or two of how we can find happiness, if that's what we want in life, that's what we benefit from, that's what we can delight in. And so I kind of encourage all of you, all of us, to take these ideas, remember these stories, and or remember your own. You know, we all have our own examples, and to see if we can cultivate, develop, and enjoy happiness in this way. So I offer these thoughts for reflection this evening.